then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your bike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's the 22nd day of May, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I got an email this week from Gretchen the Librarian in New England scolding me and telling me that I really phoned in last week's show, which I kind of did. But I imagine she's pissed off because I didn't have time to get her piece on the air last week, so tell you what, we'll let Gretchen go first this week as she's reviewing the new book, Foundations of the 21st Century by Order veteran Frank Da Silva.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss the Da Silva book, The Foundations of the 21st Century. Now, Da Silva is writing this book because he feels that we are at a perilous point. He says that our movement is coming of age, and he wants to write a book in order to smooth the path for us. Now, he talks about how we're prepared to acknowledge the rules of life, and he says that this path holds great promise, although only a few make it. But he says that our reflection must be the reality of innermost desires and needs, and we must have the courage to realize them. Now, he tells us that one of the differences between us and the radical left is that the radical left gives good press to its revolutionaries, and that we do not give ourselves the same good press. Now, he says that, yes, there are many people that will write revisionist histories, and these histories tend to get published. But he says that however controversial these histories may be, the fact is that these histories really are about harping on the past. And he says that what he would like to see is some biographies about people such as Pastor Robert Miles, people who were ordinary, people who had a solid life, had a productive and solid life within this movement, because he thinks these biographies would allow more people within the mainstream to identify with our movement. And he says that more and more, even though we're very individualistic, that we really have more and more our own culture because we no longer share the larger social culture of mores, habits, and modes. Now, when he talks about a future white nationalist state, he talks about the separation or the relative independence of various states and different geographic regions and how they're going to all be somewhat different. The other thing that Da Silva says, and this is in contrast to what Harold often tells us, Da Silva says that most people that he's encountered are really not in it for themselves. They're in it because they're sincere and they sincerely want to help. And if there are exceptions, they're fairly rare. So he has a much more optimistic view of the overall character of most people. Now, at this point, the book goes into an overview of economics, and I suppose that can be rather dry, but he's talking about the difference between capitalism and a free market. He says that it's natural for organisms to work in their own genetic interest. He does also go into science a great deal. He lists all the various scientists that have had a point of view more similar to ours or more commiserate with ours. And the only criticism that someone may have of this list is that a lot of these books are older. And someone may come along and say that these books are outdated. But it's really not so much that they're outdated, it's really more that anti-racism, like anything else, has really become a religion. And to a certain degree, scientific findings have been slanted to support that religion. The other thing is that today, whites who are in power tend to identify themselves with the principle of law. And they really do not identify with other whites, particularly ethnic whites. Now, white nationalists, on the other hand, they accept the normal state of life. And Da Silva is very optimistic about a return to these ethno-societies. And he says that even though science and religion are a duality, that they need not be opposed to each other because they serve different needs. Now, he does admit that white nationalists are in many ways outside of theology because our goals are more political and more earthly than the ones that theologians might worry about. The thing is that the white nationalists, we have our own agenda and tradition, and to other people who are outside of us, that would be viewed as a distraction. But we are about the soul, and we must burn bridges at times to go forward. Other people, they can be uncertain or they can join. Now, he says that government is an outgrowth of race, and that white nationalists acknowledge the primacy of nature. He talks about various programs to restart the economy. He talks about reforestation, hydroelectric plants, and he also talks a great deal about education, and he wants to make an education system that is more tiered to the specific interests of the individual child going through the system. I think this is to make sure that a child can have a gainful education that they can actually use. So there's a vocational track, there's academic, there's even a political track to try and get students to best use their talents. He talks about various governmental reforms or governmental ethics. He talks about people in power being able to account for any of their mistakes. He talks about price control and the elimination of corruption and speculation and profiteering, less restriction on cottage industries, public works projects. And he also talks about various reforms to the justice system. Now, he says that all ethnic groups have a right to educate their own, and he talks about the difference between conservatism and our type of activism, and he says that difference is total life. And he reminds us that democracy early on was about individuals who wanted to lift themselves out of the mass, and now it tends to be the opposite. Now, you have to understand that this book is written from an American standpoint, and he's trying to appeal not only to American white nationalists, but possibly to mainstream individuals who might read this book, at least the sense that I get. So he does give it a somewhat national slant relative to Americans. But he also does a chapter on international issues, and he says, of course, that at the end of the day, we are an international group. And he says that internationally, we could regain a certain amount of power. But he says that the world today is unfortunately arranged based on money and not based on racial allegiance. And then he goes on to list the tenets of white nationalism. And really, the tenets all have to do with territorial imperative and racial sovereignty. And he believes really in sovereignty for all races because he says that none should be deprived of their natural state. And he says that everyone has the right to secure a territory. And he also makes a statement about war profits and says those should be given back to the community. And he talks about a community where the military is replaced by militias. Now, then he goes into South Africa and he talks about the Boer genocide or attempted genocide in South Africa or ongoing genocide. And he talks about this, I think, as a warning to us. So, I'll have to warn you that there are parts of this book, especially the economic portions, that can get rather dry. And for those of us who tend to have a more international bent, like I tend to, you will tend to find this very geared to America rather than a more global or a more European perspective. And the other thing is, as I said, you will find this fairly hazy in terms of an actual territorial imperative as to how this territorial imperative will actually play out. But of course, no one really knows how things will play out. As far as a From Sea to Shining Sea takeover, I would say right now, I would say that's really a fantasy to the point where there's no point in even thinking about that. But all in all, what I really enjoyed about this book was that it is really current. And as I said before, it's definitely written by someone who is on the inside and someone who certainly has a lot of street cred in this movement and has managed to write a book that actually is, how should I put this? It's based on concepts. It's not trying to be like a mainstream book would be. It's not about look at these strange people like some of these outsiders will write. This is an insider book that really gets to the heart of issues. So this is the type of book that we should read even if we find it at times non-entertaining because it's a mature book. It's a book for someone who is mature, who really wants to think about the philosophical workings of nation building. The next book I'm going to read is The Once and Future West, and then I'm going to read the Broder Schweigen book. So thank you for listening, and really I hope you take the time to read a book like this. Hail victory, comrades.
Now, at the beginning of her review of Frank De Silva's book, Gretchen mentioned that De Silva believes we should have more of a canon of internal movement literature, biographies of great movement men and women like Bob Miles, and the female martyr Kathy Ainsworth, who was murdered by the FBI in 1968, so forth and so on. I would like to take this opportunity to address a question which has been directed to me on a number of occasions and recently has come up again in a semi-serious way, and that is the question of, Harold, why don't you write your autobiography, sort of a tell-all memoir, my life in the white supremacy movement, that kind of crap. Now, in fact, this came up recently when I was approached by some people who offered to publish and market such a book if I would write it. I turned them down, and I would like to state clearly that I have no intention at this time of ever writing such a book, and most likely never will. Now, primarily, this is because it would be impossible for me to do so honestly and completely, and if you're not going to write an autobiography which is fully complete and entirely honest and tells the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, there's frankly no point in doing so. The world is full of authors and historical figures who wrote reams of self-serving crap in an attempt to control their own narrative, starting with Julius Caesar. If I ever wrote such a book, it really would be a tell-all memoir, and that presents its own problems because, frankly, I do not believe that my story is one that needs to be told, at least not at the expense of the ideal that I have served all my life. The very things that most goat-dancing fools out there would find fascinating about my memoirs are the very things that dictate to me that if I retain an ounce of decency, I shouldn't publish them. The history of the white nationalist movement in America since 1945 is not edifying. It does not need to be preserved, and frankly, most of it needs to be forgotten as soon as we can muster up some courage and heroism and idealism and self-sacrifice to wipe a very filthy slate clean. I have often wondered what I could have accomplished within this movement if I had not been forced for decades to wade uphill, hip-deep, in toxic waste and poison vomited out by morons and enemy operatives who claim to believe in the same things I do. But the fact is, that's pretty much the story of my career, and I see no need to retell it. At least half of the problems that I have experienced ever since I became involved have come from people who claimed to believe as I do, and they were either crazy as loons, dumb as a bag of hammers, thieves and sexual perverts, or in several cases, I genuinely believe that these people were getting checks in the mail from certain sources, paying them money to deliberately disrupt my work and my life. All my political life, I have attempted to raise the tone of the white nationalist movement and demonstrate to everyone involved, to myself, and to history that, yes, we are capable of attracting true movement lifers who carry on the racial struggle with intelligence, dedication, and courage. Now, I haven't done very well. It's been like Michelangelo trying to paint the Sistine Chapel while you got a troop of rabid monkeys running around, screeching and biting and throwing the paints around and shitting all over the floor. And that is not the story in the memory that I want to leave behind. For me to tell the truth about what I've been through would simply be too demoralizing. I could actually wreck any good I've managed to accomplish. Now, believe me, the story of my life in this largely dysfunctional movement is not a story that needs to be told. These people who wanted me to write my autobiography told me, "But Harold, if you die without writing it all down and telling your side of things, you'll allow the goat dancers and the liberal scum to seize control of your narrative. Imagine all the stupid lies they're going to write about you after you're gone." Yeah, well, I admit that's not a pleasant thought. But put it this way. The facts are such that after I'm gone, for the sake of the 14 words and our race's continued existence, I would rather that people remember their lies than my truth. Yeah, it's that bad. This is Saga.
No one cries for you unless you prove that you're worthy. No one dies for you when you fight your battles on the street. So you should not waste your inheritance. Fight all your fights with your heart. It's just the way it is. Success is for those who believe.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner again. As a prelude to my talk today, which will constitute Real Politics 5, I need to rehash where I've been and express some preparatory thoughts to help you all understand where I'm taking this. My previous talks have covered important concepts like human nature, fringe politics, and race as a concept. I also covered a historically correct concept of the Constitution of the United States of America, and I'm going to recall that matter today. But it's distinct from Real Politics 2, 3, and 4. My previous talks on the matter, excepting Real Politics 1, are the basic ideas from which all the rest of my material could be extracted by someone clever enough to apply the concepts. Having said that, I must reiterate something I've said many times on Radio Free Northwest. I'm a somewhat unique case in that my political education was vastly developed before I becoming racial and later finding the Northwest Front. It would be very disingenuous of me to stop this series after I spit out a few abstract ideas and expect the audience to pick up on every consequence of the topics I addressed. The remaining portion of this lecture series will be aimed at covering concrete issues like ideology, practical application of race to said ideology, and what exactly we need to do about impending white genocide. Today, I'll cover a corollary problem to white genocide, which we white nationalists can't seem to get our heads around. Before I lose myself in my planned material for the day, I need to apologize to a few people about the delay the party has taken in answering some of their questions. Many weeks ago, a few issues and ideas were put to Mr. Covington, myself, and the rest of those populating the party's discussion board. Some of them are quite ideologically significant, and I'm certainly going to cover them. But I'm actually going to wheel around to dealing with communism first. I've planned my talks this way because how the historic American conservative scene, by which I mean older paleocons, has handled their opposition to communism is a perfect example of how not understanding very basic things, which, again, I covered in my three previous Real Politics talks, causes complete and total failure. Further, I'm going to bring up a personal anecdote which illustrates just how badly non-racists, even seemingly well-read ones, understand the world around them. That anecdote, from my own personal experience of having to relearn a subject I thought I had mastered, is a very good example of why white nationalists have a hard time making informed, mature, and responsible political choices, which is what prompted me to begin these lectures. I don't want to go into all that today, but I did mention it to confirm for some of you out there that answers to your questions really are coming. I'm sorry it's taken so long, but I have to make sure we're all on the same page about basic subjects in order to answer the questions accurately. But enough of that. On to today's talk, which I've titled The Levy Upon Honor. If that title doesn't make any sense to you, don't worry. You're in good company. I pitched this to a few of the Puget area comrades almost 2 weeks ago, and I got only twisted, confused faces for a reply. I picked this phrase up from one of the book recommendations I made while discussing race. The second Carlton Putnam title, Race and Reality, covered, among other things, a legal case called Stell versus the Savannah Board of Education. This case, taking place in Georgia during the spring of 1963, was the NAACP's attempt to integrate the Savannah-Chatham School District. Spoiler alert, it went the right way, but was overturned in appeals court. During the initial court case, the defendants, who were seeking to protect white children, made their case by citing scientific experts regarding whether or not nigglets should be considered capable of integration into white schools. If you're listening to Radio Free Northwest, you can guess how that turned out. Like I said, the trial court found in favor of white people, but the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the lower court entirely. Granted, there was issue with the precedent in the well-known Brown case. An attempt was made to halt enforcement of the appeals court, but it failed. To quote Mr. Putnam's Race and Reality on the matter, "The appeal to truth, the levy upon honor, had failed." As strange as this phrase is, it does make a certain amount of sense. And more importantly, it's an accurate observation. The basis of pro-white presentation in court was on scientific fact. It's worth noting the lawyers from the NAACP, a Jew and a mulatto, deliberately and repeatedly made attempts to convince the judge he was not permitted to hear factual evidence regarding the difference between races. In fact, Putnam noted he would have been much more worried had he known the anti-white legal case was to be made with no regard for fact one way or the other. If nothing else, Putnam's shock at the NAACP presentation demonstrates white people have a preoccupation with proving matters of truth and falsehood which we expect others to emulate. The first hard and fast basic reality I built into this lecture series is that human nature dictates facts and proof do not affect people's actions. The second basic fact about human nature is that we tend to, on the basis of whatever fact we're concerned with, expect other people to take care of whatever problem the facts were intended to convince them of. This is, perhaps, the best abstract definition of a levy upon honor I can come up with. While it is incumbent on judges and other government officials to act truthfully and make decisions based on what is right, it doesn't alter my point one bit. The last major aspect of human nature I brought up was a lack of self-awareness such that we are unaware of how others are going to react to us and the things we present them with. White nationalists are so obsessed with proof and factual validation of their racism that they can't cope with other white people disregarding the proof they offer. Once I covered human nature, I moved on to fringe politics. It could be that these blatant and egregious instances over a long period of time, where white people's needs were marginalized by society with no concern for reality whatsoever, may have damaged our collective psyche to the point where we've developed this obsession with proving our case. The underlying assumption which says people respond to factual information is simply dead wrong. White nationalism has reduced itself to spreading around as much proof of, well, lots of things, as possible, and little else. Essentially, it's a levy upon the honor of the listener. Obviously, those levies, just as levies upon the honor of judges to be just, can absolutely fail. Why, then, do we organize ourselves in such a way that we can only continue attempting something which has been demonstrated to have no effect at all? Well, that's basically the definition of fringe. It's an acceptance of and preference for losing. On some level, it could be a race-wide coping mechanism for having been so wronged, especially by those of our kin who allowed the current situation to come about. Whatever it is, it's wrong. And more critical to my case, it's within our ability to stop whenever we wish to do so. Those of you paying attention to what I'm doing will note I've quickly reviewed all the real politics basics I've discussed so far. Today, I'm taking us to a particular place which is going to briefly relate to white character. So here we go again with the white character. I'll try to keep this short. When white character comes up, one of the regular remarks made is that we must take an honest, intimate, and thorough inventory of ourselves and our behavior with a view towards changing things which need changing. This means, in addition to many other things, when we are shown examples of our own bad behavior, we are obligated to alter it. With that in mind, the reaction I received to Real Politics 4, which dealt with race, was very interesting to me. It was met with quite a bit of praise, for which I'm very appreciative. However, you'll note that I opened that particular RFN segment with the observation, a white nationalist with some time under their belt wouldn't find anything I said very interesting. I turned out to be wrong. Thankfully, I figured out why. We as a community are very obsessed with anything which we consider proof of our ideological validity. A basic overview of the subject of race will turn out to be a real crowd-pleaser against my expectations. That's perfectly all right, though. Race is one of the basic elements of genuine politics, and being familiar with the basics of any subject only serves to enhance one's abilities therein. Professional athletes spend most of their time executing basic drills, and professional musicians spend a very large portion of their practice playing fundamental scales and honing their low-level abilities. Indeed, the only way to really get good at something is to rehearse the basics over and over. Remember the four stages of learning and all that. That said, the obsession with and constant quest for proof of racism's validity shows me the other basics aren't being ingested like they should. Racial facts and reality. Being one of the basics of white nationalism is certainly something we should all be as familiar with as possible. This is, obviously, my primary motivation for reviewing the material. With all that as a backdrop for my worries, I must say I think the other two basic items I covered, human nature and the behaviors associated with fringe politics, should have been met with just as much excitement as my commentary on racial matters. I can understand why this isn't the case, and not just in light of my talk today. If you're so inclined, I suggest reviewing my Real Politics 2 and 3 talks on previous episodes of RFN, and then re-listening to today's episode. I started out today by outlining some of the places I intend to go using these basic observations. Understanding all of them equally well is essential to making mature, informed political choices. Today's talk should be sufficient to demonstrate the patterns which emerge from explaining all of white nationalism's failures, especially the failures which involve a levy upon honor, are due to not understanding or not applying these basic facts. Oddly enough, white nationalism, with the exception of the Northwest Front, can't even tell you what they want because coming up with any sort of objective to fix the racial crisis must first understand what causes it. It goes without saying anyone who paid attention to Real Politics 4 on race should be able to easily decide what needs to happen. But I'll have to cover that next time since I've gone on long enough for today. I will, however, make a closing remark about another famous levy upon honor called the Constitution. John Adams, second president of the United States, in a letter to some Massachusetts militiamen, made the remark that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Ignoring, as I should, the religious aspect of this comment, I can't help but note the obvious issue with designing a document known to have the defect that it can only restrain good, moral people. That's no sort of restraint at all. I made such observations, though not with this specific example, in my Real Politics 1 talk on said document. Levies upon honor are notorious for failing, and if nothing else, the Constitution itself is perhaps the largest levy upon honor in history. The folly of relying on this particular tactic should be obvious since it has made no dent whatsoever over the lifespan of our country. Hail victory, comrades.
And here's the second half of that bowl session Andy and I had a couple of weeks ago. I have dealt with and forgiven and taken back into my loving heart or whatever people who have said some really nasty, vile things about me in the past and who have done some really nasty, vile things. Right now, we are all white people. We need to get this thing done for our race. We have to pay all of this crap aside. But as long as we are obsessed with the idea that we cannot win, we never will.
And what's even more important about that is, again, to follow up on the hoarding analogy, what you'll see on the show is that these people, when they're actually given the opportunity to fix the problem, other people show up and say, okay, let us fix this problem for you and we'll fix it. The instant they are faced with the prospect of getting rid of something, even old ratty newspapers that are practically falling apart. And these are on about half of these shows, just by memory. Half of these shows, it's a bunch of little old ladies living alone in their house, and things are so bad in that house that they will actually either do their business in bottles and just bottle it up and leave it, or they will do that in plastic bags and tie the bag off and like throw it in the bathroom or something. Mm-hmm. These people, instead of saying, thank you for fixing this for me, they blame the psychologists and the hoarding experts. They say, it's your fault. Yes. I'm in trouble because of you. You did this to me. Or they blame family members that never actually lived in their house. They say, you were so mean to me, and it's your fault that this happened to me. Never mind that I'm the one that keeps doing this. It's your fault.
Yeah. Well, that's another typical white pathology.
That's another thing. Almost all of these people are white. There's one or two niggers and maybe one Asian. All of these people are white.
It's something that I think that's peculiar to modern white people. It's always been something that liberals and niggers and whatnot have, this idea of blaming everybody else for problems that are rooted in their own personality and their own behavior. But now white people have taken it up. It's always somebody else's fault that your life is shit. And so, again, if you don't like what's going on, if you don't like what's going on in your neighborhood with all the niggers and the Mexicans, and if you don't like what's going on with Obama, and if you don't like what's going on with this or that and the other in this country, don't just sit there on the internet and whine. We have told you what to do about it. The plan is here. We know what we're going to do about all this now. Now get with the program. And I'm raving again.
No. It's all completely relevant because the people on this show have to, the psychologists almost always find a way to confront them with something, you know, some sort of bottom line, like all their family members come up and say, if you don't fix this, we're never talking to you again, or some such thing like that. Yeah. But these people ultimately have to, and not all of them succeed, by the way. Some of these people end up with houses that are slightly reshuffled, the same mess that was in there because they were unwilling to change. If you guys don't like what's going on around you, change your behavior so that you're not around that anymore. You are the ones that have to change. When I found the Northwest Front, I had to do a lot of thinking, and I said, I'm going to change what I'm doing so that I can go do this. because this is more important. And all of you, all of us, as a race, are confronted with literal imminent extinction. And most of you want to beat your little fisties on the internet at us and saying, you know, we're being mean or unreasonable somehow. Mm-hmm. If it weren't so damned tragic, I'd be laughing at it.
Yeah.
But what also strikes me as very, very interesting, I hate to keep harping on this point because, like Harold says, it's not what you want to hear, but I'm periodically shoved into random Facebook groups or wherever else, and I'm not exaggerating one bit. There were two modes of conversation going on. Me and maybe one other person saying, hey, we should do this Northwest thing. Mm-hmm. And everybody else coming up with veiled reasons that we should do anything but the Northwest
thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I literally am at my wit's end trying to handle some of these discussions just because I'm willing to spend time with someone that needs questions answered or needs pointed in the right direction or anything like that. But there's no positive, helpful discussion going on outside of the Northwest Front. Literally, guys, everything else is people coming up with a reason not to do this.
Well, if I can once more lapse into Grandpa Simpson mode, I have been in this hair thing of ours for 46 years, if you want to count it from 1968. At the age of 15, I was with the George Wallace for President campaign, and 42 years, if you want to count it from 1972, when I joined the old NSWPP. And the one thing I always noticed about the movement, right from the very beginning when I went in, was the lack of a plan, this sense of drift that pervades our entire little subculture, this idea that if we can just somehow stay pure and continue to keep the faith and fight the good fight, or mostly talk the good talk, somehow or other, something is going to happen. Jesus is going to split the sky open, or the mothership is going to descend and blow up the White House like in the movie Independence Day, or some deus ex machina is just going to occur that is going to make it all right, and all of a sudden we're back in the days of Bobby Sox and the Brady Bunch and the backyard barbecues and this weird little Pat Boone 1950s fantasy that most white people, even a lot of white nationalists, kind of conceive as the ultimate goal of what we're trying to do. And it just doesn't work like that. You know, we can do this if we believe we can do. I know it sounds cliche. I know it sounds like, you know.
But it is not a cliche. Yeah. One of the things I found the party back when Radio Free Northwest number 30 was the hot news item of the week. Mm. Okay. There wasn't a whole lot of material to go listen to, but I always recommend people go listen to RFNs 1 through 30. Just to get the very early basis of what went on RFN. And there are plenty of references made to what we need to do in there. We don't bring this up a whole lot more, and I plan to in my Real Politics talks when I get to it, when it becomes appropriate in that series of talks. But we don't bring up our actual intentions a whole lot, largely because, well, we've got books for that we give out for free in electronic form if anybody wants them. That's actually how I read all of them the first time, by the way. Mm-hmm. But it was made very, very clear what the mechanism is by which we can obtain our own all-white country. And I had to take that very seriously because, one, I'm not carrying around all of this hoarded failure baggage that everyone else is. I had to take the claim very, very seriously. I did a lot of sitting, reading, researching. The mechanism proposed and demonstrated in the Northwest Independence novels has been tried over and over and over again, and it's very frequently successful when done right, simply because it does not rely on superior force of arms or anything like that. It's quite literally formulaic. What we want to do will work. I had to spend a lot of time thinking about that, but I'd come to the conclusion before I finished researching all of that, that if this pans out, I'm morally obligated to participate. Mm-hmm. It may be, you and I have speculated before that maybe that's the reason we can't get people to express any interest, because they know right off the bat that if they feel convicted about it,
yeah,
they need to participate.
Right. I think people are afraid to admit that we are right because they understand the implications of that admission on their part. They know that once they admit, not just to others, but to themselves, that the Northwest imperative is the way to go, they will feel within themselves morally obligated to act on that conviction, and that scares them silly because they know it's going to be hard, it's going to be inconvenient, they're going to have to give up some of their precious stuff, they're going to have to do a lot of physical labor, packing boxes and moving stuff into the back of the truck and all that sort of stuff, and they know also that eventually down the pike there is going to come the moment of commitment where all of a sudden it's not just inconvenient, it's risky. All of a sudden, there will be the knock on the door, and there will be the two droids in the silk suits and the trench coats flipping their badges at you. I don't know why people are so terrified of a simple FBI visit. They come around here, well, I won't say all the time, but they come around here often enough so they know the way. I've told you before how I dealt with them. Just merely being visited by the FBI or something like that is not something to be terrified of. And yet, to most white nationalists, it's just a thing of utter horror. Because all of a sudden, when there they are on the doorstep and they're flipping their badges, it's not a computer game anymore. They know if they admit that we are right, that this has the potential to develop into something other than a computer game. And that is what terrifies them.
Just remarking, another thought I had recently on the whole people are going to have to give up some of their stuff thing. Mm-hmm. Most regular physical possessions are things that people plan on cycling through in their lifetime. Okay, actual physical things don't seem to bother people so much. Especially Americans. I don't know what it's like in other countries, but Americans have this obsession with their houses. Mm-hmm. And what bothers me about that is one of the more regular excuses I get for people, you know, not even bothering to attempt migration is, well, they've got this mortgage or this house or whatever. And they always refer to it as a real estate investment. And I don't know if they understand fully what they're saying, but it's actually 180 degrees off.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure, Harold, you know the definition of a speculator.
Yeah.
It's someone who speculates. Have you ever gone to the grocery store and bought green bananas?
Yeah, well, actually...
Well, that makes you a speculator.
Yeah, I do.
Because
I love ripening.
You're gambling on the fact that you're going to be around to eat those bananas when they're ripe.
Mm-hmm.
That makes you a speculator. That's a gamble. You made an investment in bananas.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going to use the bananas right away.
Yeah.
You're hoping they're going to be worth something to you later. The fact of the matter is that there is no guarantee that a home is ever going to return you money. Strictly speaking, if you look at any sort of, and I don't want to recommend the resources here because there are a lot of really good resources that demonstrate why a home is not an investment, but they're written by Asians, so I'm not getting credit here. It seems like white people can't figure it out, though. It's only an investment if it can become a money-producing asset for you later. And most homes will never produce money for their owners unless they're renting them out.
That must be why all the rental properties in this part of Washington are owned by Asians.
Well, they figured it out and white people can't.
Yeah, right.
Guys, there's nothing wrong with wanting a nice house or even a nice big house, if not a nice little house, for you and your family. What you need to understand is that is always a cost center. It will always cost you money, even if it's paid off. It's not an investment. Real estate is not an investment unless you're purchasing it as part of a business plan that is going to make you money. So the fact of the matter is that it's speculation. People call it an investment because they hope in the future its value will be higher than what they paid for it in terms of real buying power.
Right, yeah.
But the fact of the matter is there's no reason that residential real estate is guaranteed to go up, and those prices fluctuate all the time. So what people have to face up to is that when they bought a house, the fact of the matter, if they're calling it an investment, what they're trying to say is that they took a really stupid gamble and lost.
Right.
The fact of the matter is it's not going to get better out there. You need to take the loss now rather than take a bigger loss later.
Well, okay, not just the loss on the house. I mean, a lot of people have bought houses, say, 10, 15 years ago in neighborhoods that were, when the house was bought, they were perfectly white and perfectly safe. And now you can probably look around and look outside on your porch and you can see the neighborhood turning. And you know damn well that not only in another 5-10 years is that house not going to be worth anywhere near what you paid for it, but it's actually going to become physically dangerous. I keep telling people, you need to practice this rule of thumb. Now, I don't care if you own your house or if your mortgage is underwater or anything, but at night, on a reasonably warm spring or summer night, open your window. If you can hear them, if you can hear the sound of booga booga Negroid voices, if you can hear the sound of salsa music, you are too close. You and your family are in danger. You need to sell that house for whatever you can get out of it, abandon it if you have to, and get the hell to the northwest. Because if they're that close to where you can hear them at night, if you dawdle, if you hang around in that neighborhood, something really, really terrible and tragic could happen. If you can hear them at night, for God's sake, get out.
Harold just used the word something could happen. Mm-hmm. The only correction I could offer is that that's not speculation. Something will happen.
Eventually,
yeah. The last time I was on Radio Free Northwest prior to us recording this, I did Real Politics 4, which was race. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to use that as a basis for the rest of my discussions. As I'm on my way over here, I was on the ferry. I was working up a script for Real Politics 5. But I'm using that as a basis for everything else. Race is the problem, and race will always be the problem. We're not guessing when we tell you something bad is going to happen. We have all of history that confirms something bad will happen because it is happening now.
Yeah.
We're not guessing, and you're just hoping beyond hope that something's going to get better. I don't have a whole lot left to milk in the hoarding analogy, but there was one episode where a guy was being kicked out of his apartment by the landlord because he hoarded it to the point where he had to climb in through the windows because you couldn't open the front door. He was one of those people that absolutely refused to actually get rid of anything because he was like, oh, he's just going to keep working on it. He's just going to keep working on it. He's going to be a good white nationalist and just keep hoping something else happens.
Right, yeah.
He was handed an eviction notice, and he was telling the camera crew that, oh, no, this is nothing. I'm going to keep working on it. You guys... All of us, I shouldn't talk, I get on people for talking about problems like they're not a part of it. I'm a part of it too. So I'm not going to distance you guys by saying you guys. We are all watching the entire world fall apart. And anyone not on board with the Northwest imperative is literally saying in the face of total disaster, oh, no, we're just going to hope this works out.
Yeah.
That's just, no, it's wrong. You're wrong. I don't know any other clear way to put it.
Okay. This is that strange group Rapus 8 again. The song is called We Will Have Our Aztlan, and this is a good example of a problem I see with this group as with most of our musical groups. The instrumental part of this group's numbers is very good, probably the best I've heard any of our groups come up with. But the lyrics are kind of hard to understand, I think, because the lead singer is using some kind of voice distorter to disguise his voice, and I can understand that, especially if these people are based in Europe, where, as I pointed out last week with Arlen Brand's piece, you can actually go to prison for singing a song. Anyway, this is Rapus 8. Right. I'm going to make a few more comments here about the lunatic crap that goes on our white internet sites, and then I'm going to shut up about it. Now, I know that the topic is depressing, and you don't want to hear it, but there is still one more angle on this that I haven't discussed for some time now, and which I need to go over again, because we do get a lot of new listeners every month, and unless you're one of these total converts to the magical sound of my voice, who downloads all 226 Radio Free Northwests and then listen to them, many of you won't have heard this discussion before. One of the biggest questions in the entire white nationalist movement, since long before the internet came along, is why these strange, disruptive people we can't seem to find any way to keep out of our movement do what they do. Now, are they simply deranged Fruit Loops who are conducting imaginary conversations with themselves, originating in some bizarro world that exists in their own mind? Or are they actual enemy covert operatives who are being paid money to spread confusion and disruption and alarm and despondency? Now, the standard answer most people come up with is, well, why can't they be both? And maybe in some cases that's what's going on, but when you think about it, that's a kind of a facile and simplistic answer. Why would the ADL or the SPLC or some government agency hire mentally and emotionally disturbed people whose performance might get erratic when they got bored with what they're doing, or who might get drunk or get drugged and give the game away? Like J.T. Reddy couldn't resist boasting to a reporter that he was an FBI informant. Now, we know from the Hal Turner case alone that the FBI does in fact hire people specifically to disrupt our wee little subculture on the internet, although I personally think it's more likely that this kind of thing is done by NGOs, non-governmental organizations like the ADL and SPLC, in order to provide the dictatorship with a couple of levels of plausible deniability, kind of like farming out the really dirty murder and torture stuff in Iraq and Afghanistan to Blackwater and the other so-called private contractors. Okay, in 2009, a Jew named Cass Sunstein was made director of something called the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Now, nobody was ever quite sure exactly what the hell this office did, or what justified Sunstein's six-figure salary and his plush office in the West Wing, but in January of 2010 or thereabouts, he got caught. At first it was by Wired magazine, and then the other media around the country picked the story up. It's hard to realize that as recently as 4 years ago, the media in this country was not totally subservient to Obama. Anyway, a lengthy memo Sunstein wrote to Obama and other top government officials was leaked to the media, wherein Sunstein proposed establishing a special cyber unit under the direct direction of the White House and, in theory, the president for what he called cognitive infiltration of internet sites, which advocated what he called conspiracy theories. In other words, any website that opposed the dictatorship of the Democrats and the One. I think originally they were meant to go after birther sites. Now, the purpose of this was openly stated, i.e. to create doubt, confusion, disruption, and eventually to make any serious exchange of information or discussion on certain topics the regime didn't want discussed impossible on the internet, because no one would be able to figure out what the hell was going on over all the noise and the madness and the cackling like loons. The unstated objective of the program was to make it impossible to use the internet or social media to build any kind of effective resistance against the dictatorship. You might recall that a few months later, the government was caught ordering what's called persona management software, which allows somebody to maintain as many as 16 different identities on, say, Facebook, each with a different IP address. Now, these people don't mind if criminal niggers use Facebook and Twitter to pull together flash mobs to rob stores or assault white people at random. But white folks are not allowed any means of lateral communication whereby we can compare notes with one another on what's happening to us all around North America. Now, of course, some people would say that the white internet was a loony bin like that long before, and it's true. It always has been, right from the first. But let's think about this now. Why exactly has our internet always been like that right from the start? Why has it always been almost impossible for sincere white nationalists to create and sustain any serious discourse on the internet, the only medium of mass communication and persuasion we have access to, before the flying monkeys descend and start trashing the forum or whatever, introducing an element of adolescent animal house behavior or obscenity or just plain lunacy that completely blows off normal people? Now, Cass Sunstein himself proposed this in a paper he wrote even before the Immaculation back in 2008, wherein he more or less admitted that various NGOs were already doing this kind of internet disruption and had been for some time, including not just the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center, but the Israeli Mossad as well, which, by the way, admits that they have a huge operation to monitor and disrupt any website or forum that is considered anti-Israel or which criticizes the Jews. Now, I am not making this up. If you don't believe me, Google Cass Sunstein and cognitive infiltration, and you can read up on this yourselves. Now, apparently, somebody in the White House didn't like all the heat that the media exposure brought on, and after it died down a bit, Sunstein was quietly kicked upstairs to Harvard Law School, which is basically the intellectual arm of the Democratic Party these days. One of the leading lights of Harvard Law School is Jewish professor Alan Dershowitz, who came up with the official legal justification for torture. But there doesn't seem to be any word on the program that Sunstein began, and it's entirely safe to assume that somewhere in the bowels of some government office building in Washington, D.C. or New York, there are rows of cubicles wherein young Jews and Democrats are monitoring all white racial activity on the internet and doing what they can to disrupt it, including listening to this podcast. Hi, guys. Did you know your president is a high yellow nigger? So, comrades, since most of you spend most of your time on the internet, from now on, when you see some shrieking loon flipping out on VNN or Stormfront or in the comments section of one of the little 100-reader intellectual blogs, trying to shout someone down, trying to tear down an idea, trying to tear down the Northwest Migration, just remember, yeah, it may be some demented white kook with more than a few screws loose, but it may be something else entirely. Okay, look, I'm not going to beat this to death. It's true that a lot of the madness you see on white internet sites comes from white people who are mentally and emotionally disturbed and who do not belong anywhere near us or any other form of alternative politics. Now, we see this all over the internet on non-political and non-racial sites as well, and sometimes that hits the news. Basically, the Jews have succeeded in destroying normal, and all white people born after 1970 are a little bit cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. But some of this stuff just looks too scripted and too coincidental and too beneficial to the dictatorship for my taste. Now, as Cicero said, when confronted with a crime, the first question to ask is cui bono? Who benefits? In whose interest is it that white nationalists are unable to conduct a sustained and serious debate or conversation on the internet without a bunch of Looney Tunes leaping in from nowhere to try and disrupt it, sometimes within a matter of hours? I have always found it remarkable that the dictatorship and the present power structure seem to have a much higher estimation of our own potential capabilities than we do ourselves, to the point where, yes, they do consider us to be worth disrupting. Maybe they know something we don't. Okay, time to wind up this week's episode, but before I go, I want to run something by you guys. Now, I don't discuss the specific number of hits on the site anymore because I've found that they're actually a rather unreliable way of determining support, since the overwhelming number of people who visit the site every week remain utterly silent and never get in touch with us, so I have no way of knowing who they are or what they're all about. However, I will go so far as to say that once we eliminate a certain percentage of our weekly site visits as being from Jews, niggers, police agents, federal law enforcement of various kinds, hostile liberals, looky-loos, and white people who are, just for whatever reason, utterly useless, I don't think it's too far off the mark for me to assert that we have a hardcore audience of around 3,000 listeners per week. Now, by that, I mean 3,000 white people who are sympathetic, who like me or like the Northwest Novels, and who would like to see the Northwest American Republic come into being so long as they personally can remain safe and comfortable in the process. Now, I know I'm always agitating for you people to post the link to northwestfront.org hither, thither, and yon all over the internet and bring us new readers and listeners, and judging by the stat counter, you do. Now, don't stop by any means. We need all the new readers and RFN listeners that you can bring in. But the simple fact is that we really don't need any more to win. All I have to do in order to bring the Northwest American Republic into being is to somehow persuade those 3,000 already existing sympathetic people among you in our audience to commit a simple, completely lawful, and personally beneficial act. I have to convince these 3,000 people to come here to the Pacific Northwest where they're supposed to be. Then I have to get them settled into at least several dozen communities around the homeland. All else will follow. The money, the activism, the picnics, the fun part, the support system, a tidal wave of further white immigration once the word gets out that there are places here where you can actually find white nationalist people and not email addresses and computer screens, so forth and so on. Not you, the 3,000 genuine people now listening to the sound of my voice. You're it. You're the magic beans that I have to pull out of my pocket. Talk to me, people. Tell me how to get through to you, bearing in mind that I cannot give you things like money or housing or other freebies. Tell me how to make this happen. I really want to know. What am I doing or saying wrong? What should I be saying or doing to get you to make the best and smartest move that you'll ever make in your life? Now, dead serious, guys, lay it on me, because somehow I have to get this right, and I have to get it right soon, because we haven't got a whole heck of a lot more time. But our time's up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.